in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. For the week of January 22nd, 2005, this is the Rain Report, the weekly audio ham radio magazine of the Internet. Now back from 7 long months away from home, I'm Blair Alper, KA9SEQ. If you missed our interview with ARRL PR guy Alan Pitts, W1AGP, it will remain online at last week's program until we post the next Rain Report on rainreport.com. Now to this week's program, which is not to be construed as an endorsement, here's Rain's producer and founder, Hap Holly, KC9RP.
This is the Rain Report. I'm Hap Holly, KC9RP in Chicago. I became a ham in 1965. One of my early antennas was a six-element Mosley TA-36 tribander. Now that was your traditional Yagi design antenna. But here in 2005, we have a major departure, and it's from stepper antennas, better known to some as Fluid Motion Incorporated. Its founder and president is Mike Mertel, K7IR. Mike, what is different about the design of your antennas?
It's a Yagi antenna, just like all the ones Yagi and UDA came up with back in the 20s. The only departure we made, and it's something I'm sure many, many hands before us and even right now have thought of, hey, why don't we make the antenna the right length? Because Yagis are essentially single-frequency antennas, so anything we do to get them to cover a wider range, say, for instance, the 20-meter ham band is about a 2.5% frequency change. Anything we do, we have to give away something in terms of performance, front to back, gain, or the match across that band staying constant. So it's a real juggling act, and it's something well worthwhile doing, as we found out, is to be able to tune it to the frequency without regard to the bandwidth consideration. We did this with stepper motors. Now, there have been antennas in the past where they were adjustable via motors and different kind of drives. Not a lot of them, but we found a few in the patent research we did. All the right technologies came about, and I was there in the right place and right time. There were things that didn't even exist back in the 50s and 60s. Stepper motors, for instance, used in virtually every printer, can position things very accurately. We make the length of the antenna exactly the right length. We're not reading SWR or anything like that. We are making an antenna that has been computer modeled, and we can repeat it time after time because the stepper motors can so accurately position the copper beryllium tape.
What's the copper beryllium tape used as?
That is actually what our elements are made of. If you look at our antennas, you'll see what looks like a regular Yagi. The fiberglass elements are full size, but inside there is a flat, half-inch wide, fairly thin, 8 thousandths of an inch copper beryllium strip. That's a special alloy that's very spring-like, just almost like the Stanley tape measure. And it is very conductive. It's a little better conductivity than most aluminums are. Very good for extending out into a tube because it's spring-like. We put a crown in it just like a tape measure, and it's actually the antenna element.
So you actually are changing the length of the elements, but not the spacing.
We lay the elements out on the boom at a fixed distance. To move the elements would be a mechanical nightmare that, in our modeling, it just didn't seem like it would ever be worth it. So we were happy to just make the element length change so the spacing stays the same. So that's the compromise, if you will, on our antennas is we never move the elements. So down on 20 meters, for instance, we look more close spaced than we would on 10 meters. So on 10 meters, our antennas will have more gain, less front to rear. And on 20, it'll have a little less gain, but better front to rear. It makes a perfect Yagi on 16.55 megahertz. If you're an SWL listener, you've got a Yagi tuned to whatever frequency within the range. Most of our HF Yagis cover 20 meters to 6 meters continuously. So if you want to go up and listen to WWB on 15 megahertz, and you just put your radio there, you have a very good Yagi right on the WWB frequency.
That's the dream of every SWL, of course.
And we've had a fair number of them buy them for that reason. They weren't ham radio guys. And that's been the primary interest of commercial and military kind of operations because it's really outperforms a log periodic by a wide margin. The reason people generally don't make short boom Yagis is because it limits the bandwidth so severely. That what you suffer and gain is not huge. You can make a higher front-to-rear ratio on a 0.25 boom length than you can on a 0.3. A lot of people consider 0.3 wavelengths to be the ideal boom length. And it is very good because you can get pretty darn good gain and pretty good front-to-rear. But an antenna 0.45 wavelengths long has the best gain you can get. Our three-element beam, for instance, has a 0.46 wavelength boom, and we achieve 9.4 dBi gain in free space. That is very near the theoretical maximum you can get out of a three-element beam. Now, if we go down on 15 meters, well, there we can only get about 8.5 dBi on the supposedly ideal boom length. The moral of the story is there's no ideal antenna height and there's no ideal boom length. It depends what you want. We found that by stretching our antenna down to 0.25 wavelengths on 20 meters and going up to 0.46 on 10, it's a darn good compromise.
For the mathematically challenged like me, how long of a boom are we talking about?
We're talking about what to most people would sound like a pretty short boom on 20 meters. It's only 16 feet long. So on 10 meters, that looks like it's twice as long electrically. So if you look at most classical antennas, you don't see many high-performance Yagis anyway putting them on a 16-foot boom. But as you can imagine, everybody's got their old antenna or their buddy's antenna. They've spent hundreds of hours comparing them. And I think they're surprised as well as we are really how well we do against much bigger arrays, because a lot of multiband antennas don't use the whole boom length, or they're using traps and reactive loading and whatnot. We can keep that performance at every frequency we go to because with our transceiver interface, it will follow the radio. It listens to where the radio is going, and then it adjusts the antenna to that within 50 kilohertz. Any closer than that is kind of a waste of time.
I would gather the way the antenna tracks where the radio is due to a computer interface of some sort.
Exactly. Most of the modern radios built after 1990 have a digital output of one sort or the other, RS-232 usually, but some sort of a digital comm link that you can plug into, and they will broadcast what frequency they're on every couple hundred milliseconds or something. And we simply read that, and every 50 kilohertz, we re-optimize the antenna. Now, you can also adjust our antennas manually. You can change bands, and within each band, it'll have segments. As you push the band button more than once, it'll cycle from low end to the middle to the high end and back to the low end. And then at any time, there's up-down arrows that you can hit, and you can adjust to within 25 kilohertz of the frequency you desire.
This kind of antenna design negates the need for an automatic antenna tuner like you find in so many radios today, correct?
It really does, because it's essentially very close to a one-to-one SWR all the time. There's no variation from one end of the band to the other, and there's no variation from 20 megahertz clear up to 50 megahertz.
I'm speaking today with Mike Mertel, K7IR, the president and founder of Stepper Antennas, known in the past as Fluid Motion Incorporated. We'll be right back. This is the Rain Report.
You're listening to RainReport.com, the only authorized internet source for Rain audio.
Let's talk more about the actual construction of the antenna. How are the motors encased?
The antenna element housings, we call them, within this box, it's about 3.5 inches high by 8 or 9 inches long by 5 inches wide. In that are what would look like two reels of copper beryllium, much like a tape measure reel would look like if you took a tape measure apart. And the motor is inside there, and it drives both beryllium reels at the same time using a fiberglass shaft with two stainless steel sprockets on it. One strip goes out one way out to the element, and the other strip turns and goes out the other way. They never get out of sync because they're both sprocket driven. The beryllium actually has punched holes in it. It's not being pinched by a roller or anything, so you don't build up error by slippage or anything over many, many extrusions. It's a sprocket drive. It'll never get out of sync. So that's all in one box, and on the driven element, even the Balin-Unan combo is inside the box, which allows the lead length to be very short from the balun to the actual driven element, so you don't add additional length inside the box there. It starts out right at the start of the element there. There's maybe an inch and a half of wire between the balun and the start of the antenna element. The box sits right on the boom, and it's actually the support for the telescoping. They're telescoped when you get them, but you permanently put these very strong, it's a fishing pole manufacturer that makes them, very strong fiberglass elements go into this box, which is right in the middle of the boom. So you got one 18-foot element on our 20-meter and up model going out to the right, one going to the left. So the beryllium starts right at the center of the boom. One goes one way out 18 feet, and the other goes the other way out 18 feet, thus making a dipole for the driven element. You know, we started out designing this. We thought, oh, we'll make this out of telescoping aluminum tubing with a threaded lead screw that makes it go in and out. And then we started thinking, wait a minute. If it's been up in the air a while, that aluminum is going to corrode and it won't make good contact. Heck, we might not even be able to get it to move after a while. Then we had the eureka of put the element inside of a non-conductive support. And we didn't even realize when we thought of it, hey, this is also going to protect the element from snow static, rain static, and wind even can create static noise in your antenna when charged particles hit it. But when they're inside the fiberglass, you don't hear that. So it was just a serendipity kind of deal there.
What kind of challenges have you had to deal with your antennas being in some extreme climates?
Well, they're all over the world now, so we have quite a large number out there now. So they've pretty much seen everything. They've been up to the Arctic, and they've been all over, and they're mounted permanently right down at the seashore, in the tropics, and everywhere else. My biggest fear, and believe me, at Dayton, every ham from the Northeast would say, what about ice? We get ice up in the Northeast. And we didn't really know. We knew how strong the pole was, but we weren't quite sure what the dynamics would be with the ice on it. We even went up to a local ski resort here, took up water in jugs there, and we iced up the element and just measured how much they drooped and tried to get them to ice up to the point they would break, but we couldn't get that much ice to form. But in the interim, in the last 4 years, we've had many pictures sent to us. The last one I saw, it was an inch, and he measured it, of radial ice. You know, there's a reason they make fishing poles out of fiberglass and not aluminum. It's tremendously flexible, and it causes it to shed the ice quicker, too. So we've had very good luck. I would say our antennas probably take ice quite a bit better than the equivalent aluminum antenna, unless maybe you took one that was especially made to take ice.
Now, all this wonderful technology does come with a pretty hefty price, though, doesn't it?
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, that's one of the things we realized early on. You know, the stepper motors and copper beryllium tape is not inexpensive. And we forged ahead because after building the first prototype, the advantages really were tremendous. So the ability to switch the direction of the antenna, you can switch 180 degrees in about 2 seconds by simply having the microprocessor creates an antenna going the other way. It makes a reflector where a director was and vice versa on the other end. So there's all these little things that played into it. And then when you started thinking about it, think, hey, now, wait a minute, I'm getting all the work bands. I'm getting 6 meters. And when you start, especially with our bigger antennas, you start to replace a whole bunch of antennas that all of a sudden you need a bigger rotator or another tower and a rotator to hold all this stuff. So at the end of the day, if you really get out there and look at it, we still think we're a good value.
You have a directional model for 40 meters?
Yes, we have a model we call the Monster. We kind of got carried away with our cute names. The big vertical is the big IR, the small IR, but I'd heard so many names like, you know, the BCR2250, I thought, you know what, I'd rather have a name. So we went with names, and the 40-meter through 6-meter model is called the Monster, and it has 3 full-sized elements, that's about 70 feet long, on a 34-foot boom, and then it has a 4th element that's only 36 feet long. So the antenna functions with 3 full-sized elements from 7 megahertz to 14, and the minute you hit 14, the 4th element comes into play, and then it's a 4-element beam all the way to 50 megahertz, and then we offer 2 passive aluminum elements that makes it a 6-element beam on 6 meters.
And what kind of price class does that antenna go for?
That antenna sells for $3,800. I'll just give you a real quick thumbnail sketch here. The verticals are down around $500. the two-element beam, which is unique in its really short boom, 57 inches, $845. Then the three-element is at $1,198. The four-element is $1,745. And then, of course, the monster I just said was $3,800.
57-inch boom. That's
just shy of 5 feet, 3 inches shy of 5 feet. But we followed the good advice of W6SAI, Bill Orr. He said in his beam book, for the most bang for the buck is a two-element on a very short boom. About 0.08 wavelengths is what that turns out to be on 20 meters. So that's what we did, and we modeled it, took it out to the range, and we thought, you know what, Bill, you knew what you were talking about. Whenever you hear from the manufacturer, you have to take it with a grain of salt, going, well, of course I'm going to tell you this is the greatest thing in the world. There is an independent stepper user group under Yahoo, and Kilowatt 3 Bravo Zulu, Jerry Keller's he's the administrator. There's about 700 people belong to that, and you go post a question on there, and you'll get the truth out of a lot of smart guys that 90% of them probably own them, and they'll tell you what's good about them, what's bad about them, and the whole scoop on it. And that's really what I recommend anybody that has any interest at all in these antennas. Just go pose the question on that stepper user group and see what they say.
I've been speaking today with Mike Mertel, K7IR, the founder and president of Stepper, that's STEPPIR, Stepper Antennas, formerly known as Fluent Motion Incorporated. For the Rain Report, I'm Hap Holly, KC9RP, in Chicago.
The proceeding is not to be construed as an endorsement. However, if you do plan to attend the Dayton Hamvention in May, Stepper will be one of the exhibitors there. Editorial note, like so many of you, we had not heard of this company until a sighted ham friend of Hap's told him about it literally last week. If you know of a fledgling ham radio manufacturer, feel free to drop a note to Hap at rainreport.com. That's H-A-P at rainreport.com. The Rain Report is copyright 2005 Rain, all rights reserved. I'm Blair Alper, KA9 SEQ.